From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Newgrange was built 2,000 years before the pyramids, before Stonehenge. And we're still unravelling. I mean, archaeologists are still unravelling the mysteries there. And they are mysteries.
Their grand vision is to really see people living and working on the moon.
My collection, I've used like a lot of dead stock fabric.
Dead stock fabric.
Yeah.
What is that?
Coming up on this Forever Autumn edition of Playback Daily. Yeah, but where are we really from? A new history of Ireland explores our origins. Giant steps are what you take working on the moon. And we find out just what dead stock fabric is. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that specialises in dead stock audio. Okay, let's get started with the Oliver Callan morning monologue, delivered all this week by Dermot Whelan, and news of a panacea for those of a hangry disposition.
There is good news for hangry people in Dublin because Deliveroo has announced that it is teaming up with drone delivery company Manna to launch drone deliveries in Dublin. An initial test phase will begin in the coming days and will be available to people within a 3 kilometre radius of Blanchardstown in Dublin 15. So it's a limited area right now. Something similar, of course, has operated in other parts of the country. I know we're in the Galway area. Something similar was running there. Deliveroo said customers will be able to order from local restaurants and have the food flown to them in as little as 3 minutes once the order is ready. The drones will be flying at speeds of up to 80 kilometres per hour. When they arrive at your house, the drone hovers and lowers the food to the ground via a secure biodegradable tether, usually in a driveway or garden. All perfectly normal. Manna has already completed over 170,000 delivery flights in the Dublin 15 area, but there have been some complaints from residents about the noise coming from drone deliveries. Locals in the area say the sound is like a lawnmower or moped, which can be quite annoying. Manna says, though, it is using a number of measures to reduce noise levels and that it would welcome further regulation. But you know what it makes me think? How long before the seagulls cop on? They are far too devious to let something like this pass them by. I know, I've been attacked by enough of them. They're like, you can just see the seagulls up there thinking, wait, we don't even have to land on the ground to steal their food now. We could just pluck it straight out of the sky, stupid humans. They're practically flying it straight into our nests. You can picture them sitting on the roof, can't you? Just watching all the dinners fly by. Chicken korma, Tony? Nah, had that last night. Quite fancy a spice bag, I think, this evening.
Another proposition for our seagull overlords could be actors floating in the sea, waiting to be eaten.
Sometimes, did you know, it pays to die. You have probably never heard of the character Alex Kintner, but the man who played him in a very famous movie is making a lot of money 50 years after his screen debut. Now, Alex Kintner is the 12-year-old boy that is seen being devoured by the menacing great white shark Jaws in the film. And now, 62, the real man, Jeffrey Voorhees, who played the child, the man who played him all those years ago, says he is still being flown all around the world to appear at conventions. And they flock to his website to buy signed T-shirts and photos and all that kind of merch. He can earn as much as £10,000 sterling for each appearance he makes, which is incredible. 50 years later, back in the early 70s, he was just a local kid from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, who saw that they were making a movie down the road at his local beach. He put himself forward as an extra because he heard you could make $40 a day, which was a lot to a 12-year-old. Next thing he knows, he's spending 5 days in the pounding surf pretending to be eaten by a mechanical shark and swimming around in vats of fake blood. Of course, the best part for him, he says, was that he got to meet the stars of Spielberg's classic, which included the brilliant Richard Dreyfuss, Roy Scheider and Robert Shaw. Now, Shaw, who played the shark hunter Quint in the movie, you may remember. And it was very exciting for the young actor Voorhees to be surrounded by these incredible stars. In fact, he tells the story of meeting Robert Shaw for the first time. He says Robert Shaw was sitting on the beach over by the fire, away from everyone else. We were just little kids and we went, oh, let's go over and say hello to him. We all ran up to him and he sounded like he did in the movie. We could smell booze off him. And he went,
get away from me, you little shits.
which shows that you should never really meet your heroes, folks. It sounds like a scene from The Simpsons. But amazing, 50 years later, to be still making all that money from such... He was only on screen for about a minute, so he must be just thanking his lucky stars all his life.
Who knew being an extra, sorry, background artist could be so lucrative for so long? Meanwhile, Dermot has some thoughts about some guy called, checks notes, Jeremy Clarkson?
Some of you might be watching Jeremy Clarkson's TV series Clarkson's Farm, which is on Prime. And it documents the former Top Gear presenter's trials and tribulations while trying to run a farm in the Cotswolds. But not content with just buying a farm, he has also bought a pub called The Farmer's Dog. Now, I have to say, I never thought I'd be a fan of this show. I just thought Clarkson was kind of an irritating, mouthy, brash alpha male who loved saying everything was the greatest thing in the world. But my wife and I gave it a reluctant go one night, and I've been absolutely glued to it, I have to say, ever since. Despite growing up in Limerick surrounded by farms, I didn't really know anything about farming or the things that were involved, other than being chased out of the odd hay barn for playing in there as a kid. But I found the show does a really good job of explaining farming all through the eyes of the hapless Clarkson, who really makes a dog's dinner of most of the agricultural tasks set out in front of him. And British farmers have been really pleased with the show in general because they finally feel that they have a strong voice in the media that is highlighting all the issues that they're dealing with. And now The Telegraph is asking today, can Clarkson's farm save Britain's pubs after he has now bought a pub as part of the show? Because he's a glutton for punishment. It reports that there were more than 60,000 pubs in Britain in the year 2000. That's fallen to 45,000, according to the British Beer and Pub Association. The reasons for closures include higher taxes, the pandemic, people just not coming back to the pub as much after, and energy prices. So people in the industry are saying that Clarkson is now shining a spotlight on the difficulties that pubs face, as well as the farms. And I guess so much of it applies here too, doesn't it? Irish publicans here said they are hitting breaking point and people are not going to pubs as much anymore because of the prices. That is definitely something that is putting a lot of people off. Education around alcohol. We just don't drink as much. We were talking about that on the show yesterday. And a change in consumer behaviour. Again, we spoke about how younger generations preferring things like going to the gym rather than going to the pub. And according to a Drinks Industry Group of Ireland study, get this, some 114 pubs on average have closed across Ireland every year of the last 18 years. So that's 114 pubs every year for 18 years. That's an incredible number. Certainly something I notice when I drive around the country on tour, I have to say. I noticed that recently. Just the amount of closed pubs in towns and villages are ones that look closed, but maybe they only open at the weekends.
Which must be when all the weekend drinkers come out of the woodwork with a fierce thirst. Next, Dermot brought us some sad nostalgia celeb news.
Cast your mind back and have a think about what posters were on your wall as a kid or a teenager. It's okay, you don't have to admit it out loud. You can just remember who was looking down on you as you slept. I always think these are the special bands and music that kind of stay with you, don't they? And you feel a pang of nostalgia every time you hear the music or read something about them. And one band that definitely populated my County Limerick bedroom wall in the 80s was A-ha. And one story that's in all the papers today is the sad news that Morten Harket, lead singer with the Norwegian group, has announced his diagnosis with Parkinson's disease. The band, of course, are famous for hits like Take On Me and The Sun Always Shines on TV. And Morten says he's having issues with his voice due to the condition, which causes parts of the brain to become progressively damaged over many years. And he actually underwent treatment last year for the condition. He had a neurosurgical procedure. I didn't even know you could do this, but he's gone through it. Electrodes were implanted deep inside the left side of his brain last June, and he had a similar procedure on the right side of his brain in December. And while they've softened the impact of his symptoms, he still says he's not sure how the disease is going to affect his voice and his creativity in the future. It's a lot to be dealing with, but actually it's the way he's speaking about his situation and the diagnosis that actually had an impact on me this morning when I read it. Because he says on the A-ha website, he's 65, and he says, "I'm trying the best I can to prevent my entire system from going into decline. It's a difficult balancing act between taking medication and managing its side effects." And then he says, "There's so much to weigh up when you're emulating the masterful way the body handles every complex movement, our social matters and invitations, our day-to-day life in general. I've got no problem accepting the diagnosis," he says. "With time, I've taken to heart my 94-year-old father's attitude to the way the organism gradually surrenders. I use whatever works. What a beautifully accepting way to greet that kind of news. I'm not sure the rest of us would feel so philosophical about it, particularly at 65, which in the scheme of things is young. And the band actually have had a bit of a Kate Bush moment just a few weeks ago, finding new audiences, as these things tend to happen, when Take On Me featured in the post-apocalyptic drama The Last of Us. After finding an abandoned music shop, Ellie, who was played by Bella Ramsey, gave us an Armageddon rendition of one of their big songs. Very nice. It goes to show that even in an apocalyptic future, there's always somebody with a guitar who takes it out, and you all have to sit there and listen to the murder one of your favourite songs. You'd be wishing for the zombies to come through the window. But we wish Morten Harkett all the best.
Indeed we do. And as he's a keen listener to the Playback Daily podcast, he'll be chuffed by our thoughts and prayers. And on that blessed note, let's take on us to leave the Oliver Callan monologue behind in the pencil dimension, or wherever that was in that aha video. You know yourself. Today, Claire Byrne tells us, is an important day for European space exploration because the first European moon rover, Tenacious, is due to land on the moon this very day. Claire spoke about this to Dr. Jennifer Millard, extragalactic astronomer, whatever that means, and host of the Awesome Astronomy podcast.
If this does manage to land, is it a pretty big deal?
It is. It's a huge moment for European space because this is the first European-built rover on the surface of the moon. And while it's only small and it's more of a technology demonstration, you know, there's not a lot of science on board, it is a huge step forward.
And the Japanese company I mentioned, iSpace, what is their aim in all of this?
Their grand vision is to really see people living and working on the moon. So around the 2040s is when they're anticipating this happening. That seems like quite a quick timeline to me, but it all depends how these technologies develop. Mm-hmm. And so these early landers are the first stages because they have to learn, first of all, how to get to the moon, soft land on the moon, practice deploying different payloads. So this is how it begins. And they've got plans then to ramp up the missions, make them bigger, more complex. But we all have to start somewhere.
So the little rover called Tenacious, it's small, but it has an important role, does it? What is its role? What would it be doing?
It does, yeah. So it's somewhere in size between a toaster and a microwave. Right. So it really is a very small rover indeed. It only weighs about 5 kilos. So yeah, tiny. And this one is just to test technologies about moving around on that lunar surface. It's quite different to the hard ground we have on the Earth.
And what can we?
It's very powdery. It's covered with what we call regolith. So it's a bit like flour.
Mm-hmm. Will we be able to see what it's doing because it has a camera, or will the controlling crew be the only people who have access to that?
So it's not fully clear whether we will see the live feed as they're seeing it, but they will be getting a live feed so they can drive this rover around in real time. And I think that is the best job in the world that I've ever heard of, driving a lunar rover around almost in real time. So hopefully they'll share that footage with us almost, you know, as soon as they can. But it'll be amazing to see what this rover is seeing almost in real time. We just got that couple of seconds time delay because of the distance between the Earth and the moon.
So it will be taking pictures and picking up stuff.
Yeah, it'll be scooping up some of that lunar regolith, that powdery surface, to see how it moves about when it's manipulated. It'll be taking photographs of the lunar surface. Also, there are some payloads on board. So there's one called Moon House, which is an art payload. So it's a tiny miniature sculpture of a house, which kind of symbolises iSpace's hopes of people living and working on the moon in the future. So once that's deployed, it'll take photos of that. It'll take photos of the lander to see what condition it's in once it's touched down on the surface of the moon. It's got a lot of jobs, this tiny little rover.
Mm-hmm. And people are concerned about the conflicts that exist between commercial and government organisations when it comes to space exploration, Jennifer. And iSpace is a commercial operation, as you've said. What's your own view on that?
I think this move into commercial space is actually great for government agencies because it means that the commercial ones, they focus on actually building the landers, the rovers, that hardware, and it frees up time and money for then the government agencies to focus on the hardcore science, which they are best equipped to do because they've got decades of experience which they can build on. They can do more sophisticated and advanced experiments. So I welcome this collaboration, but I think that's the key, is it has to be a collaboration, you know, those private companies working with the government in tandem. And, mm-hmm. and this is what we're doing. So, yeah, for me, it's quite exciting.
And what do you think the possibilities of this mission might be? What might it lead us to?
So in the future, we expect more missions from iSpace, and the rovers will become bigger, the landers will hold more payloads, become more complex. We'll then see an increased frequency in landing. But of course, that is, we're talking years and over decades of development. So it should lead to some very exciting things. And as iSpace said, they want to support human activities on the surface of the moon, not just like in the days of Apollo, where we went for a few days and then we came back. This is all about long duration exploration, people really living and working on the moon, you know, being up there for weeks and months. And then that is, of course, working towards getting people to Mars eventually.
All right. Any chance we can get Elon up there sooner rather than later? Please and thank you. That's Dr. Jennifer Millard, extragalactic astronomer and host of the Awesome Astronomy podcast, talking lunar landings with Claire Byrne this morning. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, our host spoke to the Brown Thomas Designer to Watch winner, Clodagh Levy, who's just finished being a fashion design student at NCAD. And Clodagh told him what it all means for her.
Congratulations. So what does this mean, Designer to Watch at the Brown Thomas Arnott's Bursary Awards? What's it mean to you?
So it is based on my final collection, like my grad collection. Brown Thomas came in to have a look at it, and now I get to display my clothes in Brown Thomas over the summer, which is amazing and like still doesn't feel real. But yeah,
that is amazing.
I know.
Isn't it?
Crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's such a huge opportunity and I'm very excited.
So you've just left National College of Art and Design.
Yeah.
Out in Dunleary. Tomorrow, those same clothes that are going to be in Brown Thomas are on display in the college.
Yeah.
Is it open to the public?
Yeah, it is. It's the NCAD Works, so it's on from the 6th of June until the 14th, and it's all of the final years at every department, so fashion, textiles, painting, everything. So you should definitely come and have a look.
So when you're applying for NCAD, it goes on a portfolio, does it?
Yeah, it does. So I think you have to like pass everything in your Leaving Cert, but the portfolio is like the...
So that means it's at 17, 18, you're creating stuff.
Yeah. So I did my portfolio. Well, I think I started it in like fifth year and then I just worked on it. But my Leaving Cert year was during COVID, so I had like extra time to do it, which was actually quite handy.
Yeah.
I was working on it for so long.
So tell us what your collection's like then. What inspired it?
So my collection is based, it's called Anna's Studio, and it's based around my granny, Anna Marie Levy, who was a watercolour artist for over 60 years. And she was just always my biggest inspiration growing up. Like, I always wanted to be like her. And she really got me into all of the creative things. Like, my dad is also an artist, like her son. So, like, her creative genes are obviously very strong. I just really wanted to pay homage to her with this collection. So it's very bright and colourful and is lots of fun, just like her. So, yeah.
And you're saying was, so...
Oh, yeah, she passed away last summer. But yeah, which is very sad, but I'm glad that I got to show the world. Like, it's just very exciting because a lot of people are like, your granny was so cool and she was so fun. And it's nice that everyone else gets to see that as well now, because I always knew that, obviously. But yeah.
And did she know that you were going to do this?
No. But she's always been so supportive of my like fashion career and everything creative I do. So hopefully she's proud. And
yeah. What a lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, keeping her memory alive.
Yeah. And it's really nice because some of the prints and like embroidery and stuff in my collection are like of her paintings. So people can also see her work and her personality. And yeah, I'm really glad that I got to like honour her in such a creative way.
Will you talk us through how you go about dreaming up something and then making it a reality that somebody can wear.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of trial and error. Like, you have lots of bad ideas before you get to the good ones.
Right.
But lots of sampling. I do like loads of, because textile and like embellishment and decoration and stuff is a big part of my work. So I do lots of sampling, and then you make lots of mock-ups of different things before they are realized in the final fabrics. And fabric shopping also like inspires pieces as well. Like, I went over to London a few times to have a look at different fabrics, and that really influenced a lot of my designs because I wanted to be like very diverse with the fabrics I was using.
So what fabrics did you use?
So I used lots of this. It's like a PU fabric, kind of like latex.
Right.
Lots of tulle, lots of this like cotton and silk, leather. I made a pair of leather gloves. So many fabrics, and some outdoor fabrics as well. So, yeah.
This is a sort of an older man question, but it appears to me, walking down the street and looking at people and what they're wearing, that all bets are off, that the rules of fashion and trends don't seem to apply as much as they did in the past.
Yeah, I would agree. And especially in an environment like NCAD, like, everyone is like so...
Of course, yes, themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like such a good environment to be in because, like... I remember on my first day I wore like it was literally just a jumper and jeans, and then everybody was dressed crazy, and I was like, I can dress like this too now, finally.
And oh, right, you
so
found your tribe.
Yeah, so I don't know, because I feel like in Dublin sometimes, I don't know, everyone kind of dresses the same sometimes.
Oh, right. Okay.
But I feel like nowadays, especially in the past few years, like, there is a lot more like diversity of fashion, which is exciting. And... yeah, definitely in a creative space like art college.
So you now finish college.
Yeah.
And the real world beckons.
Yes.
And it's calling you to London.
Yeah.
Who are you going to be working for?
River Island, which is exciting.
Yeah.
I won another bursary, and included in that was a 3-month paid internship in River Island starting in September. Which is very exciting, and I'm really grateful for that opportunity as well. So I'm moving back to London. Well, I lived there last year.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And, you know, because I'm sure they talk to you out in NCAD about, you know, who gets a job, who's successful. Do they talk about the fact that not everybody's going to be a designer, or...
No. Kind of. Well,
do they?
Not really.
No.
I feel like, I don't know.
Is there a job for everybody is what I'm asking, really?
Yeah. Well, like... I feel like not everybody has to be like a huge designer. There's definitely like, that's not the only job you can get out of doing fashion design. Like, there's loads of jobs out there, like more behind the scenes and stuff. So, yeah.
But you want to be a name.
Yeah, eventually.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Yeah. Hopefully one day I'll have my own brand. But yeah, I definitely just want to go to London. I feel like London has like such a great fashion scene, and... Yeah, I'm very excited.
And what about sustainability and the arguments, you know, against fast fashion, and we need to be more sustainable, we need to wear clothes longer.
Yeah, we definitely do. And I feel like in my collection, I've used like a lot of dead stock fabric.
Dead stock fabric.
Yeah.
What is that now?
So it's basically, there's this company from Italy called Fabric House, and it's basically like the end of fabric rolls. So like... it's not being...
Yeah, end cuts, like you go to a carpet shop and you
go, So I used a lot of fabrics from that website as well. And it is a bit trickier because like with the dead stock fabric, there can be like damages and stuff. Different cuts in it, and you just kind of have to work with it. But I mean, at least it's a bit more sustainable. And all of my pieces are designed to be worn over and over again. And
you know, whenever you look at a futuristic movie...
Yeah.
Inevitably, people dress in sort of utilitarian type stuff.
Yeah.
That everything's a lot more simple. It's sort of long sleeve T-shirts.
Yeah.
You know, not a lot of detail, not a lot of colour.
Yeah. That's not a bit of me.
No.
The future of fashion is colour. At least that's the way designer Clodagh Levy sees it. And who are we to argue with the Brown Thomas Designer to Watch Awards winner? Clodagh was talking this afternoon to Ray Darcy. Meanwhile, back on Oliver Callan, Dermot Whelan wants us to listen to this.
Ireland, a small island on the edge of Europe, between the old world and the new. These seas were not barriers. These were our highways, charting the ebb and flow of an island people. The landscape itself bears the traces of our history.
Good man yourself, Colin. That's a clip from a new documentary series about Thol Saad called From That Small Island, which kicks off on RTE One and the RTE Player on Sunday. The series is the brainchild of historian, writer and filmmaker Brianna Nic Iarmadh, who joined Dermot Whelan in studio this morning.
How do you decide what's going to go in and what's not?
Yeah, with great difficulty, I have to say.
Yeah.
It's the simplest answer to that one.
I suspect your original pitch wasn't four episodes, but yeah.
No, it wasn't, to be honest. To be fair, it was six, actually.
Okay, right. Well, even that's a tremendous feat. But yeah, it travels right back to the very first inhabitants of Ireland. Who were they?
That's a really good question. And to date, archaeologists, I'm not speaking here as an expert myself, but from our conversations with archaeologists and increasingly with geneticists, science has really moved on, Dermot, you know. I think you mentioned you've got an archaeology degree.
I do. Thank you for making me feel it more relevant.
Well, indeed.
It's not
absolutely
often I get to talk about it.
Everyone should have an archaeology degree. At least some of us certainly should.
Yeah.
But the developments in scientific techniques, you know, being able to extract DNA and now the analysis of ancient DNA, and to be able to extract actually from sediment, not just even from bodies, but from sediment, ancient DNA, can tell us so much more than we ever knew before. So there's always in that sense a revision going on as to who the first people were.
Who do we think they were?
So at the moment we start the whole series down in a cave in East Cork with a group of archaeologists.
Yeah, that's a fascinating clip.
It is, and we were down there in that cave, my God.
Scratching away,
trying to find sediment. And what they are, there's a man called Richard Jennings, he's an archaeologist and he's a specialist in the Paleolithic, that's the really earliest times. And he's searching for Neanderthals. He's a specialist in Neanderthals. And of course, we don't have any Irish Neanderthals. But he's convinced that he will find evidence down there of that, which of course will completely revise our whole idea of who the first people to come to Ireland were.
When do we think the first ones were there?
Well, to date, I think the accepted view is that there were hunter-gatherers who came here by boat about 8,000 years ago. And they were here for a couple of thousand years. So we do have evidence of those, archaeological evidence of those of those people. And then they disappeared. And then another group of people came in. And these were our first farmers. And they have left us again. They have left us wonderful evidence. And say, Cage of Fields, for example, up in the northwest coast. And the wonderful work Seamus Caulfield has done there, you know.
Yeah.
And we were reminded very much of Seamus Heaney's poem, Bel Derg, you know, when he talks about the stony soil of Mayo, or the stones of Mayo.
You hear him reading it in the show. It's quite poignant, actually. And the TV programme really taps into that mystery of our past and those really searching for clues. I think of going up to, you know, the Aran Islands, you go up to Dunaingus. And you're wondering, who were the people who built this phenomenal structure?
This is it, and these incredible structures like Newgrange, and these were our first farmers, you know.
Yeah.
And that Newgrange was built 2,000 years before the pyramids, before Stonehenge. And we're still unravelling. I mean, archaeologists are still unravelling the mysteries there, and they are mysteries.
Yeah.
And the people who built those, then they disappeared into the mists of time, and another group came. And we've got more evidence there because we're now into, say, the Bronze Age.
Yeah. So, well, you mentioned the science and the latest discoveries in science. And there is a really amazing part of the first episode. People don't have to wait long to get to it. But where the scientists found a skeleton and then they used the latest technology to recreate the face, to really bring to life. Tell us about that. This is the Rathlin man.
Yeah, that was really, I suppose, for me, I love prehistory. I didn't study archaeology, but I'm fascinated by that deep, as people were calling it, the deep past.
Yeah.
You know, how can we know these people from the deep past? And so we came across this wonderful woman up in Belfast in Queens, Eileen Murphy, and she'd been working on a skeleton that had been found in Rathlin Island. In a dig, there was a cist burial, that is to say, a stone burial. And it was in danger of the dunes coming in and destroying it. So a community archaeologist did a dig there and they recovered three skeletons. And one of them, this person we're calling Rathlin Mann.
Yeah.
And so Eileen's been studying him, or Dr. Professor Murphy, I should say, has been studying him over many, many years. And she's an osteoarchaeologist, right? So she studies bones, basically.
Yeah. What's lovely is you get the impression from when you're watching it that she has this real relationship
with this
skeleton, like they're pals.
She's
because they spent so much time together.
Yeah, she's totally wonderful. And she looks at these, she says, you know, she says, it's a skeleton, she says, but it's also a person. Like it's someone's brother, someone's father, because it's a male skeleton. But she can tell things like, for example, that he had wonderful teeth. That he was between 40 and 60, which was quite an age. And he was
5'11". Yeah, because you get the impression that maybe when you look at door frames on cottages from the 19th century and stuff,
exactly.
You think we were all tiny. But actually, 5'11", that's a good height.
A very good height.
And a very healthy body in terms of the time
and she reckoned that he would have probably had, given the burials, he was buried with a pot beside him, that he would have been of high status. So, and ancient DNA is something, again, that has cast really new light on these people from the deep past. And there are two people in Trinity in particular, two geneticists, Professor Dan Bradley and Dr. Lara Cassidy. And they've been to the fore, really, in developing this whole technique of the analysis of this ancient DNA. So from that, and they studied the DNA of this skeleton from Rathlin, that Professor Murphy, so they were collaborating. So they were able to come up with much more detail as to the skin tone, the eye colour, the hair texture. So using that DNA analysis and using the 3D of the skeleton, 3D photographs taken in the lab in Queens, we were able to commission FaceLab, which is a cutting edge, I mean, really the cutting edge forensic laboratory in Liverpool, John Moores University, to reconstruct the face of this Rathlin man.
Well, it's a great moment where Professor Murphy herself, who spent so much time with the skeleton, gets to go in and we go with her. And it's the first time that she sees the face of this human that she's been spending so much time with. The general consensus on the team here this morning was that he looks quite like a hipster barista. That if he's so knocking around.
Spot on, actually.
Randala, you know, with a roly in his hand. You'd be like, okay, yeah. But yeah, really interesting. And we were quite dark skinned back then. Our ancestors had darker skin. We associate freckles and all that with Irish skin, but it wasn't always the way.
Yeah, well, this particular individual had lighter skin tone. And of course, this is a hugely controversial area. I mean, my goodness, you draw everybody out from under stones when you start talking about this stuff.
Really?
But Rathlin Mann had, so they were able to prove from this DNA that he was part of a group of people who had come from the, what's known as the Pontic Steppes, basically Russia and Ukraine today. So these people moved after about 4000 BC, they moved across Northern Europe and they ended up on Irish shores.
Yeah.
Like so these were the people they brought with them, we think, a Celtic language. So this individual, they were able to prove that this individual is really one of our genetic ancestors.
Okay.
So he had, you know, reasonably fair skin, brown eyes, although he had the gene for blue eyes as well, but his eyes were brown. But also he was lactose tolerant, which means he could drink, his diet was primarily milk and dairy. And again, that adds up to evidence of a strong presence of dairying in the country. You know, we should have gone to the dairy board, I think, for sponsorship because, you know, this idea that Ireland
right
is
back.
Right back to prehistory.
That is a lot of milk drinking. Professor Brianna Nick-Yermida, creator of the new documentary series From That Small Island, talking to Dermot Whelan this morning. The series, narrated by Colin Farrell, starts this Sunday on RTE One and RTE Player. Back on Today with Claire Byrne and the remarkable story of the self-help book that refused to die. Jim Murphy, former pro baseball player, published a self-help book in 2009. 15 years later, it was languishing in the nether regions of Amazon's sales charts. Then A.J. Brown, a player with the Philadelphia Eagles American football team, was seen reading the book during a game on live TV and, well, things rocketed from there. The book's author spoke to Claire this morning and told her how he found out about A.J. Brown reading his book during a live game.
I was in Dallas, Texas, in a hotel room by myself. It was kind of a slow, somber time in my life. My mom was actually in hospice, dying, died 4 days later. Business was slow. And I'm watching a football game. It was actually a bowl game, Penn State playing Notre Dame. And I look at my phone, I see all these texts, and then I check one and it says, you need to turn on the Packers-Eagles game. And that's when I found out with the rest of America.
Mm-hmm. But what happened? I mean, the text messages started and then the momentum grew from there, didn't it?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it was an avalanche of messages, to say the least. Like, the one really cool thing that happened that night was, so, I mean, right away, phone calls, texts, messages, direct messages, everything, emails, that I couldn't keep up with them all. And there's a TV station in L.A. said, we need your book in a couple hours tonight. And so it was just the beginning of this immense abundance craziness.
But part of the irony is that you already knew that this player, A.J. Brown, was reading your book, didn't you?
Well, I saw that he had the book. I just didn't know that he was bringing it to every single game, using it to get prepared mentally and reading it during the game after every drive.
Mm-hmm. Is that exactly what you had hoped initially, way back when you wrote the book first, that that's what it would be used for?
Well, it's far beyond my dreams. I never imagined something like that would happen. But you never know when God's doing great things.
Mm-hmm. You said you were going through a difficult time in your life. I mean, it couldn't, dare I say, have come at a better time for you, really.
Well, you never know what God's up to. You know, it's so often you think that, man, this is so hard. Why is this happening to me? When the exact thing that's happening to you could be the very best thing for you. God's always training you.
Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, what happens inevitably when you have a celebrity endorsement, if you like. The book started to sell in massive units and numbers. And as I said earlier, it flew up the charts from that point.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I actually had a affirmation on my phone. I'm a New York Times bestselling author. And, you know, it first came out in 2009, revised in 2020, but it never really sold, never really gained a lot of traction until that week.
Mm-hmm. And then at the Super Bowl, what happened?
Oh, yeah. I mean, January 12th was the first game, and then they win, of course, and they win the next one and the next one. And so AJ's reading it on the sidelines between plays every single game, including at the Super Bowl. And so Super Bowl, obviously, they zoom in on it there and they show him and the coach both looking at it and talking about it.
Incredible. I mean, you couldn't have paid for it, could you?
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is the most important thing here to understand is this is not about the author. The author is just the messenger. The message is that selfless is fearless and that we can all be fearless.
Mm-hmm. Listen, tell me about the Irish connection, because there'll be people listening to this who heard that your name is Jim Murphy and they'll go, well, Jim has to be Irish with a name like that. But the connection is even deeper. And I know you do have family connections here.
Oh, yeah. I'm not only am I Irish, but I'm born on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day.
That's good. But tell me about the connection in terms of the book and how the book then became very popular in sporting circles in the States.
Yes, this whole journey started off in Ireland. This is really an Irish miracle. So I spent 5 years full-time writing and researching Inner Excellence, 2.5 years in the desert. That's where it all got started, in the desert in the U.S. And when I came out, I the book was in bookstores around the world, but I had isolated myself, and we're created for relationships. And when you isolate yourself from others, you're really in danger of having some sort of anxiety breakdown. And that's what happened to me. I had a near mental breakdown. And I'm actually walking into a friend of a friend's house about a year after the book came out. And his mother calls in on a video from Ireland. And I said, oh, tell her. I said, hi, as I'm walking out the door. And she said, my friend wants to talk to you. And I was like, okay. And this lady I'd never seen before, she said, everything that you've been going through has been training for you. God's going to bring people from all over the world to work with you. It's going to happen soon. And you're going to know it's from God.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks later, I'm asleep in my room and I hear a voice and it said, Jim, are you ready? Things are going to happen fast. And I assumed it was God because I lived alone. And then a few weeks after that, I get a call from Jude O'Reilly, a Dublin golf caddy, pro golf caddy. And he said, I read
Excellence. People listening, I'm sure, will be familiar with Jude O'Reilly, particularly in the golfing world, because he's very famous as an Irish golf caddy and someone who is very au fait with these sorts of training methods that you advocate, right?
Yes, absolutely. He's very talented. And so he read Inner Excellence and he said, Jim, my boss, Henrik Stenson, could really use this. Can you talk to him? So I fly out to Sweden. I start to work with Henrik. And then he heard about it because he was in the produce section. And a friend of his was at the produce section and was like, hey, how's it going? Oh, I read this new amazing book and you should read it. And so really this all started in Ireland in the produce section. And yeah, it just, my life took off from, Inner Excellence took off from there.
Now, Jim, you've mentioned God a number of times and the role that your faith has played in all of this. And you also mentioned going through a crisis when you moved to the desert. Were you always a Christian or did that come as a result of spending that time alone?
Well, I always believed in God, but I really went my own way. And, you know, there's two big turning points in my life. And one was right after I was in the desert and had spent 5 years full-time writing and researching Inner Excellence. And I had this near mental breakdown and you would think that I would be super excited with, you know, the books and bookstores around the world, but I had spent all my life savings. I was $90,000 in debt. And that's when I called my friend and say, hey, tell me what to do. And he said, find a homeless person and help him. And that was that day right around the corner was this homeless harpist playing a full-size harp. And it's my life really changed on that day. Mm-hmm. And it was really a surrender to God. And this is the power of even in groups like AA, the 12 steps, the power is to surrender your little strength for the unlimited strength of the universe.
That's former pro baseball player Jim Murphy talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the remarkable journey of his self-help book, Inner Excellence, Train Your Mind for Extraordinary Performance and the Best Possible Life, which is published by Orion Ignite. Patricia wrote an email this morning to Liveline, and Katie Hannon, sitting in for Joe Duffy, got Patricia on the phone on this afternoon's Liveline.
I suppose I'm many things. I'm outraged, I'm furious, I'm heartbroken, I'm ashamed of our sector, I'm ashamed to say that I'm a nurse in a nursing home. I'm just ashamed of how we are treating the people in our society. It's just appalling.
I'll just remind our listeners, Patricia, that you're the Patricia McGowan, Director of Nursing at Nightingale Nursing Home in Haskra. And people might remember at a very, very bad time in terms of our engagement with nursing homes and the whole nursing home sector, at the height of the COVID pandemic, you were talking to Joe about the situation you had found yourself in that day, because we were being told by the government that help was being sent out to all these nursing homes that were struggling because staff were coming down with COVID and residents were coming down with COVID. And you brought us the news from the front line of what it was like for you on a day when I think almost all your staff and almost all but one or two of your residents had tested positive for COVID.
That's correct, yeah.
And I think people will remember it was a very powerful contribution that day, and it really opened everyone's eyes to what was actually going on inside nursing homes at that time. Tell us, we saw that programme by RTÉ Investigates last night. And just say great credit has to go to Aoife Hegarty, who's a reporter on it, and indeed the undercover healthcare assistants who went in and brought us out those, really exposed what was going on in there, and the initial whistleblower indeed that raised the red flag in the first place. And I mean, it was, there's no way of saying it was a very hard watch. There is no doubt
absolutely
about that.
Absolutely. It was traumatic to watch it. I mean, I watched it with the lady that owns the nursing home here. She's dedicated her entire career to looking after older people. And she turned to me at one point and she said, have I wasted my life? You know? And I'm here 16 years and I'm wondering, what am I doing? You know, at the end of the day, I know, okay, this was pertaining to a particular organisation. But at the end of the day, the broader public out there are going to treat it the same as they treated Lee's Cross. It's going to be every nursing home is the same. They're all bad. They're all money grubbers. The care is dreadful. And that just isn't the case. It isn't the case. I mean, it was reported earlier on your station, 87% of nursing homes are now compliant with the health regulations, the Health Act 2007. We have learned. We've learned from Lees Cross. We've learned from the introduction of HICWA into the equation.
But Patricia, I have to say, just on exactly that, like, I think the difficulty that emerged from last night's programme is that in the case of one of those two nursing homes, and these are nursing homes for, that are being run by a very large group, actually the provider of the largest number of nursing homes in the country, the Emis group, and that they, in one of those homes, they were entirely, if you had looked at the HICWA reports from that nursing home, and it was very, you know, it was they had people in there, they were listed, you know, that they were compliant again and again and again. So there is now an issue, I think, for a lot of people, was can we trust these HICWA reports now?
I understand that comment, but at the end of the day, it's very difficult when you have a situation where, I don't know, a team of two or three inspectors, whatever it is, goes into a facility on a given day. I mean, all they're taking is a snapshot, really, of that facility and the care being delivered in that moment. You can't really know a situation unless you're embedded in the situation. And I mean, at the end of the day, a policy can say anything. A response to a report can say anything. Paperwork can say anything. And that's part of what HICWA looks at. It looks at the paperwork. It looks at your policies. It looks at your responses to complaints and all that kind of thing. And that's an important part of the service. But at the end of the day, they can only take a snapshot.
In terms of what we witnessed on that programme last night, I mean, there were so many examples of, I mean, I'm going to say the word poor care, but that hardly covers really what we were watching.
I'm afraid I'd use stronger than that now, but okay.
Exactly. And I'm sure most people would. But for you, like, what was your sense? As somebody who is in the sector, who understands what the needs of residents in these homes. And again, we've got to realise that these are not patients. This is these people's homes we were in last night.
Yeah.
And so just from your perspective, Patricia, what did you take away from it, you know, mostly?
I took away lots of things, really. I think a facility that has 115 or 120 or whatever it may be beds, that's not a home. That's a facility. That's an institution. It's not possible to run it as a home. Home means home. I mean, I had a gentleman that said to me this morning when I come in, "Good morning, darling, how are you?" And he offered me a cup of tea. Now, this gentleman is not in a position to get up and make me a cup of tea. He just physically isn't able to do that. But he offered it to me because this is his home. I'm visiting his home. And that's the way it should be. Smaller rural nursing homes, that's the service they offer. These big conglomerates that have 115 beds or whatever it may be, they're not there to provide a home. That's not a home. That's my opinion anyway. It's not a home. And I think there was a lot of emphasis on being short-staffed and supplies not coming in and all that kind of thing. Look, we've all faced days when we've been short-staffed or a delivery hasn't come in on time or whatever the case may be. But being short-staffed doesn't automatically make you unkind or disrespectful. It doesn't strip you of your humanity. And, you know, dragging someone along by the trousers, is that a lack of staff? I don't think so. I think that's a lack of care. Wiping your hands on a resident's clothes, that's not a lack of supplies. That's a lack of respect. There just seems to be no compassion and no empathy and no respect. And at the end of the day, it's like that girl said on the television last night, this could be your dad. This could be your mom. Would you be happy for them to be treated that way? And one of the girls on the program last night, one of the staff of the facility said, "I wouldn't put my mam in here, not on my last breath." Now, what does that say about the service she's providing?
Yeah, and I do think watching the staff last night and you know, again, it was a very hard watch. And I did hear Ronan Collins, the consultant who was part of that programme last night, this morning comment on this. And he used the phrase empathy burnout, that if you are working under very difficult conditions where there is a care culture that's not what it should be, that you know, ultimately means your ability to empathize with the people you're caring for just diminishes over time, and that's how you get people who behave like that towards the people they are caring for.
I understand the concept, but that doesn't excuse it. If you reach the point that you feel I'm not doing this to the best of my ability and I don't care about these people, then it's time to get out.
Strong words there from Patricia on this afternoon's Live Line, talking to Katie Hannan about the Primetime Investigates programme, which aired on Wednesday night and exposed the shortcomings of the services provided by a leading private residential care provider. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Dermot Whelan has a question for you.
When did you last send or receive a card or letter in the post?
It's been a while now that you mention it. And that's because, Dermot informs us, it's a habit that's on the way out, with less than half the letters and cards being sent today compared to a decade ago. Author Ethna Shortall, an avid letter and card writer and sender, doesn't count if you don't send them, spoke to Dermot this morning about the joy of sending and receiving actual physical letters and cards.
Is it postcards, letters, thank you cards? Are you across the board on this? And how did you get back into it?
I think I've aged out of letters. Like, I had pen pals as a kid, and when I lived abroad in my early 20s, I used to write to friends. Like, we could have sent emails. I'm not that old, but there was something lovely in the letter. But I think you get older, you get busier, and letters have fallen. But I am an avid card sender. Christmas, I go very big on Christmas. But that's like your chance to shine, you know. And you also can shame other people into sending cards if you get in early enough.
I think it's a sort of a mixed emotions when somebody sends you a Christmas card or a thank you card or something, because you go, oh, that's lovely, and think, oh my God, I'm a terrible person, I never send anything. You know, you might get a WhatsApp if you're lucky.
And I think sending cards throughout the year then, like, it wouldn't be great for a birthday card, but for a kind of unexpected card, like if a friend is having a hard time, or if you just see something that reminds you of someone. I was thinking about it, and I remembered that last year I was in the National Gallery, and there's a painting, a portrait there called The Fisherman's Mother, and it reminded me, now it's of an older woman, but it reminded me of a friend of mine who lives in Germany and what she's going to look like when she's older.
So she must have been delighted with this.
Not now, Kira. Not now, but in a few decades' time, I see this. It just reminded me of her. And it made me smile, so I bought the postcard in the gift shop and I sent it to her straight away. So.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. It's when you see it, buy it, send it. The thing, you know, how many of us have maybe even bought the card and then it sits in a drawer for 6 years, you know, because you never actually got around to posting it?
Yeah, I think if you think about, like, you know, you go on your summer holidays and you might think, right, this is my chance to send the postcards. And you buy the postcards very early on, but it takes you forever to locate where you buy stamps or, you know, to remember to actually write them. And you end up going home with the postcards in your back. So I think if you want to send cards, the kind of, you have to do it as soon as you think about it. Because if you buy it and you put it in the bag, you'll forget about it. And then a week later, you'll think, oh, sure, it doesn't really matter anymore, you know.
Well, you know what? The stamp thing is true, because just the other day, my wife said to me, here, have we got any stamps? And I was like, I don't think we've had stamps in this house since 2002. Like, it used to be a thing of your mother would have some stamps in the drawer. And we were chatting about it earlier that even if you did that now, the price of stamps changes every 4 days.
Yeah.
So the ones you have are probably obsolete.
I think they have to honour them. That's what I've heard anyway. And I'm saying it now on National Airways, so it has to be true. But because I have one little booklet always in my purse. Always is there now, because that's when you're out and about and you buy the postcard and you can send it straight away. And then we have one on the whole table. But the one on the whole table, I think, is from the previous price, but they seem to still be getting there. So I think we're OK.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I have a cousin that I have recently reconnected with after many years, and we've become best buds again now. She lives in America. Hello to Patricia Whelan, if you're listening online. And she is a great postcard sender. And her enthusiasm and regularity of sending postcards reignited something in me. And now, not only me, but even my kids are getting involved in sending at least her postcards. And it's a lovely thing. And what I discovered along the way as well from another cousin of mine was that they have the, on Post have these prepaid postcards that you can get. So you don't have to go through the rigmarole of buying the stamp. It's already paid. Have you seen those?
No, I haven't. I'm not familiar with this. But see, I have my stamps, Dermot, so I'm more prepared than you.
You are. What was it Maeve Binchy said about,
yes,
about sending postcards?
Well, Maeve Binchy has this paragraph, and it's I have it printed out in my office. It was advice that she was giving to her niece, and it's really short, but it's full of wisdom. Things like, don't worry about what other people are thinking, they're not thinking about you, or call everyone by their first name, from doctors to presidents. But she has a great line in it that is, write postcards, letters take too long, and you won't do it. A postcard takes 2 minutes. And honestly, I think that when I first read that, I think that was the impulse for me becoming a postcard sender. I was like, you're right, Maeve. I think of people, I think fondly of them, I miss them, I'd like to let them know. I'm just not going to sit down and write a letter, but a postcard's doable.
Yeah, do you know something else, Ethna? You know, when we were younger, we used to remember our best friend's phone numbers. And I'm sure,
yeah,
you still have a few of those
I
rattling around your,
yeah,
head.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. But also, we used to know people's handwriting. If you got a letter in the door, you'd go, oh, that's from my sister, or that's my godmother, or whatever. I don't think we know each other's handwriting anymore.
The only handwriting I think now, friends, it's the ones that send the regular Christmas cards. So I see them coming in the letterbox. But I have a couple of cards that I've kept, and some of them are from work-related things, but a couple are from my grandmother because they're sentimental to me, but also because she just had the most beautiful handwriting. And there definitely is a generational thing where, I don't know if it's because we don't practice as much or the emphasis isn't put on it. I blame being left-handed on my own, like, mediocre handwriting. But, like, her handwriting and a couple of other women that I knew of that generation, just so beautiful. And, like, there's a little note on her notice board, and just looking at it makes me happy, that, like, delicate cursive writing.
Yeah, but even I don't even recognise my own handwriting, because I realise the only things I write on are maybe, like, a shopping list, or maybe you're putting an address on an envelope. And even if I'm doing that, I have to really concentrate, because my writing has, as my mother would say, gone to pot.
Yeah, and you're also, you don't write anything of length, like you say. Like, I write for work, like when I'm plotting out stories, I write like pages of, you know, like getting to know characters. But I can see it descending into absolute, like, just mess by the end, because I'm so unused to writing at any length.
That's author Ethna Shortall talking to Dermot Whelan this morning about the dying art of writing and sending letters and cards. And that's all I have for you on this big, beautiful edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether bigger, beautifulier look back at an entire week in radio. But from me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.